The headlines: Hamas political leaders issue a strong warning to Israel, saying the Palestinian resistance will not tolerate the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Moscow displaying the no-entry sign to almost 1,000 prominent Americans, including President Biden, reciprocating similar moves by Washington. And Australia's incoming Prime Minister pledges fresh relations with the world following elections that ended conservative rule after almost a decade. Thanks for joining us. Hamas says there will be no let-up in Palestinian people's resistance against the Israeli regime. Chief of the Resistance Movement's political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, made the comments in a televised speech on the anniversary of Palestinian Operation Sword al-Quds. During that operation, Palestinian groups in Gaza fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response to a brutal bombing campaign against Gaza. Haniyeh said the operation targeted the Israeli regime's security, that it was not limited to specific geographical territory, but was a strategic battle with a global spillover effect. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on Jenin refugee camp. Another Palestinian teenager was also critically wounded. The Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammad Shataya, condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident came days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. Correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says most victims of Israeli attacks in the occupied West Bank in recent months are teenagers.
Since the beginning of this year, 20 Palestinians were killed only in Jenin. Some four of them are under the age of 18. This Palestinian who was shot dead this morning, Amjad Al-Fayed, he's only 17 years old, and even less than this. His friend, 18 years old, was seriously wounded during this Israeli military operation to Jenin. We can say that many of the Palestinian youths and Palestinian young men continue to be engaged in the different forms of resistance. And maybe in the last few months, we are witnessing more Palestinians are holding arms, trying to prevent the fully armed Israeli soldiers with their armored vehicles and tanks from raiding Jenin refugee camp. According to witnesses and according to Palestinian paramedics in the Jenin refugee camp, Amjad Fayed was shot by almost a dozen rounds in his upper part.
Well, breaking news from the Iranian capital, Tehran, where a member of Iran's Revolution Guards Corps has been assassinated. Colonel Sayed Khodayi was killed as he was entering his home in eastern Tehran. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists around 4 p.m. local time. The IRGC has called his assassination an act of terrorism. The force says it has launched the necessary measures to identify and arrest the terrorist. U.S. sanctions have severely impacted human rights. That is the grim assessment by a top U.N. human rights official who has slammed the United States for its brutal sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Elena Duhan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time. already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000 and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Duhan said, the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The U.N. rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Duhan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the fear of health. The situation in Iran is the following, that some medicine are produced domestically. At the same time, the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries.
Well, the U.S. Special Rapporteur Elena Duhan has highlighted the negative impact of Washington's unilateral coercive measures on Iran, urging their immediate removal. But Iran is not the only victim of U.S. sanctions regime. Washington has sanctions over 22 countries, and one of the most affected is Venezuela, where, based on one report, thousands have died as a result of sanctions.
Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision-making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis, hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
Well, we brought you news about how an IRGC member was assassinated. At this point, arrests have been made. The IRGC has made this announcement directly coming from them as a source that it has arrested members of the sabotage network in Iran, which, based on their assessment at this point, which they have made public in the form of breaking news they see there, they are affiliated to the Israeli intelligence apparatus. So obviously it shows how swiftly and quickly IRGC forces have acted, arresting the members of the sabotage network affiliated to the Israeli intelligence apparatus, which is responsible for the assassination of an IRGC member, which pretty much happened within the past hour or so. Moving on, Russia blacklists over 960 U.S. citizens in response to Western sanctions. Leading Americans on the Russian Foreign Ministry's list include President Joe Biden, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. The individuals are banned from entry to Russia indefinitely. The ministry says the sanctions are necessary to counter the U.S. attempts to establish, quote, a neo-colonial world order on the rest of the planet. Moscow has already blacklisted State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Russia, however, says it remains open to honest dialogue and that it draws a line between the American people and authorities inciting Russophobia. Ukraine's president believes that there is only one way to resolve the ongoing conflict with Russia, and that is through diplomacy. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine did not start the conflict, but it has to finish it. According to the official, even though Ukraine can be victorious on the battlefield, a breakthrough will only be reached at the negotiating table. Meanwhile, an aide to Zelensky has said that there is no way that Ukraine would agree to a ceasefire or accept any deal with Moscow that involves surrendering territory. Mykhailo Podolyak, who is also Ukraine's lead negotiator, says making concessions would backfire because Russia would hit back harder after any break in fighting. Currently, the negotiations are deadlocked, with both sides accusing each other of stalling the process. Russia has launched fresh attacks in Ukraine's Donbas and Mykolaiv regions as it seeks to secure and expand its gains in the country's east and south. Russia's defense ministry says that they pounded Ukrainian positions with artillery and airstrikes. The ministry says three command posts and four ammunition depots were hit. Also, over a dozen areas where Ukrainian troops and military equipment amassed were struck. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say that eight civilians have been killed in the Donbas region. They say Russia bombarded Kharkiv in the northeast and Zaporizhia in the southeast. Russia launched its war in Ukraine on February 24. The most important city it has so far taken control of is Mariupol, a strategic port in southeast Ukraine. Additional information coming on the assassination of an IRGC member. The IRGC has come out and made an announcement of arrests that have been made. And here it's saying that under the guidance of the Zionist regime's intelligence service, the network attempted to steal, destroy public property. That's interesting there, but that's the statement coming from the IRGC. Hopefully we'll get an explanation at what it means by the attempts of stealing and destroying public property. Italy has increased its imports of Russian crude despite efforts by the European Union to reduce dependence on Russian energy. Russia has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude oil to Italy this month. That is more than four times as much as in February, and the highest since 2013. Two-thirds of those exports are destined for a port in Sicily, where a Russian-controlled refinery is located. Lenders have stopped financing the refinery after the EU imposed sanctions on Moscow over Ukraine. This has forced the refinery, which is owned by Moscow-based corporation Lukoil, to rely solely on supplies from its parent company. The growing crude shipments to Russian-owned refineries in the EU come as the bloc is working on ways to wean itself off Russian fossil fuels. Australia making a transition from a conservative rule to a Labour government, with the incoming Prime Minister pledging fresh relations with the world and a transform of climate policies. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. The Labour leader has called his upcoming summit with the Japanese, Indian and U.S. leaders an absolute priority. Climate is expected to be at the heart of the talks. Albanese and his government are expected to be sworn in on Monday after Labour winning a parliamentary majority in general elections. He may still need a coalition partner to rule, but he has indicated that they will be picked from like-minded independents. The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of conservative rule in Australia, which is now associated with climate disasters such as burning forests and smog-enveloped cities. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
An investigation reveals the immigration agency has collected data on most Americans. It's the latest case in a worrying trend, says Farah Hassan, a foreign policy in focus contributor, in an article published under the heading, ICE is spying on American people. Here's more. Almost 1,200 innocent people, mostly Muslims, were rounded up and detained after the September 11 attacks often for months without charges. Arabs and South Asians were racially profiled and deported for minor immigration violations. The FBI began surveilling mosques across America. As part of the Homeland Security reforms following 9/11, the U.S. Congress created the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE agency in 2003 to ostensibly fight terrorism and enforce immigration law. But the truth is, ICE went on to use its newly established authority to spy on nearly everyone across the United States of America. An independent two-year investigation has now revealed that ICE collected data on hundreds of millions of Americans under a legally and ethically questionable surveillance system, largely outside of public oversight. Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology uncovered this dragnet after filing over 200 Freedom of Information Act requests and reviewing ICE's contracting records from 2008 to 2021. In its report released on May 10th, the center found that ICE has spied on most Americans without a warrant and circumvented many state privacy laws, such as those in California. The authors conclude ICE now operates as a domestic surveillance agency. ICE has carried out this surveillance by turning a third parties like state departments of motor vehicles, large utility companies, and private data brokers like LexisNexis Risk Solutions. From these sources, ICE gained access to driver's license data for 3 in 4 adults living in the United States and scanned a third of the license photos with facial recognition technology. ICE is also able to view over 218 million utility customers' records across the U.S., including for over half of California's residents. This surveillance network has unsurprisingly hit immigrant communities hardest. The agency has targeted immigrants for deportation by cruelly exploiting their trust in public institutions, such as when undocumented people apply for a driver's license or sign up for essential utilities like water and electricity. These practices point to an agency that has clearly overstepped its boundaries. ICE does not have the congressional authority to do this kind of bulk data collection on the public. This overreach underscores the need to shift U.S. immigration law away from a deportation-driven status quo. Unfortunately, this ICE program isn't an isolated case. It's part of a broader domestic surveillance apparatus that spans decades and multiple federal agencies, including the FBI, CIA, and NSA, and ultimately impacts all of Americans. During the 1960s and 70s, federal agencies spied on anti-Vietnam War protesters and civil rights leaders. More recently, in 2013, whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed that the National Security Agency created a massive surveillance program that secretly gathered telephone records on millions of Americans, regardless of whether they were suspected of any wrongdoing. And this February, newly declassified documents exposed the CIA's own secret bulk data collection program to spy on Americans. The type of data remains classified, but Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich have called for greater transparency on the agency's surveillance of Americans. Americans should all be alarmed by this growing domestic surveillance state. Left unchecked, it corrupts public trust in U.S. democratic institutions and undermines U.S. civil liberties, most notably the embattled right to privacy. The history of the U.S. regime surveillance demonstrates that Americans can never take this right for granted.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, meet at the time of return from the trip. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the rights of the neighbors and meeting them at the time of return from the trip. According to the Islamic teachings, it is necessary to pay attention to the rights of the neighbors. And due to the importance that the neighbors have in the Islamic teachings, obviously we must take care of their rights. One of the rights of the neighbors, according to the Islamic teachings, is that we must meet them at the time of return from the trip or a journey. And obviously we know that people, when they go for a trip or a journey, maybe they are having a good time at that trip, or maybe they are having a bad time in that trip. And on top of that, when someone goes to the journey, obviously, maybe they had no issues, or maybe they had issues in their traveling. So when they're coming back, it is necessary to go and visiting them, to meet them, to ask about their journey, to know how the journey was, and to be aware of their financial position as well. Maybe someone has gone to a specific trip, and there he was in need of money, and he maybe had taken a loan from someone, and after that he is in need. So basically, when we are going and visiting our neighbors, and when we are asking about their trip, or maybe we just generally going and meeting, maybe they are discussing their issues with us, or maybe they are sharing the experience that they had in there, and this experience can also help us in our life as well, for example, if we want to have a trip. So it is necessary to go and meet them when they are coming back from a trip. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of meeting the neighbors at the time of return from the trip. In the Islamic lifestyle, we see that the teachings of Islam tells us that if you want to have a proper Islamic lifestyle, you need to give importance to the rights of the neighbors. And therefore, Imam Zainul Abidin has said that وَتَأَحْهُدِ قَادِمِهِمْ, that you must go and see them when they're coming back from a trip, when they're coming back from a journey. We know that in the past, people used to have, they used to travel and it was a long way. They were traveling maybe by walk or maybe by horses. But in today's world, there are the planes, cars, and there are other means, trains, for example. But obviously, even in today's world, it is necessary to go and visiting the neighbors when they're coming back from a trip, so that we know about them, we can be sure about their health position, health status, or maybe the financial, or maybe if they have a need and they shy to go and say to their neighbors or to share with someone, when someone is going there and visiting them by himself, therefore they might open their issues or they might ask for the help if they are in a specific need. And it is also ethical that when someone comes from, when someone goes to a trip for a specific days, for maybe for 3 days or a month or a week, when he's coming back, we go and visit them. That in a case that even there was no issue and they had a good trip, because they were away for a couple of days and we were unable to see them in these days, therefore we go and ethically, we go and we meet them. It is ethical to see them and to wish them or to welcome them that they are back home. So these are the ethical things that we must perform and we must take care of our neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
Yeah, all clear there. Left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation. Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too. And,
it's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze, well, you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just cover them and stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, OK.
About there.
About there?
Yeah.
And you can Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole and they crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on. Digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
The drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to sniff around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Kills the entire weed, roots and all.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 2,4,5-T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gal sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 2,4-D. Tests on one 2,4-D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 2,4-D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D.
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides, and that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products. What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he's constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
The cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking out from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
you've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals and the environment. It's yet to finish that review. Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995 but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believe this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.